Many parents have had the experience of taking your children to see where you grew up. Many parents have had the experience of discovering that your children don't care where you grew up, and that as you grow misty-eyed with nostalgia, they're squirming in the seat of the car, wondering when they're going to stop for lunch, whether there are any good restaurants left in your old neighborhood, and just why you would imagine that this would touch them. But as those children grow, they do start to develop an interest in where parents and grandparents grew up, because now they have a distance between their growing up and themselves. And they realize that a connection to the past, both immediate and distant, is a very powerful and profound motivator of human life. And that's when, all of a sudden, is awakened in that child an appreciation of history and a realization that the world didn't start yesterday or last week or last month or last century, but that we are part of a continuum. And the more we understand that continuum, the deeper is our insight, not only into our times, but into our souls. Last week, I talked about a trip that I took to Rome and the way in which the Jewish community of ancient times managed to preserve itself, and why it managed to preserve itself in the face of the greatest empire that the ancient world had known, the Roman Empire. Why, despite destruction, persecution, opulence, pressure, Jews remained Jews. But of course, Rome is a city distinguished not only by the magnificence of its ancient history, but also by its importance throughout the ages, and in particular in the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and the art that it produced, and the civilization that it, in a sort of rocky and uneven way, shepherded until modern times. And one of the things that every Jew is obligated to do when visiting Rome is to visit the Roman ghetto, the Jewish ghetto, which is a very, very small area. Some 4 square blocks is the entire Jewish ghetto. It's not much larger, actually, than Sinai Temple. And if you go, and I say this in a parenthetical commercial announcement because I promised them I would, Jewish Roma does tours. There, I have discharged my obligation to Jewish Roma. The tour was wonderful and informative and important. And as I was walking around the ghetto and looking at what remains of it and hearing its history, the same question recurred again and again, which is, how did the Jews survive this? Why did they not dissolve into the culture around them? It was clear in part why they didn't dissolve into ancient Roman culture, which was in large measure a worship of power. And the Jews believed that they worshipped something transcendent, that wasn't material, that wasn't at bottom empty. That Romanness as an ideal was a much baser and thinner ideal than the ideal of faith. But here we have a different question. Because Christian society was a society of faith. And even though it didn't always live up to its ideals, it still had ideals that were not in their primary nature incompatible with Jewish visions of God, of a messianic time, of something that was transcendent. And anybody who doesn't block off their emotional response out of ideological convictions can't help but walk into the churches in Rome and be moved, not just aesthetically moved, but spiritually moved, by the soaring cathedrals, by the devotional art, by the promise of a civilization that would draw human beings higher. So how did we stay in that small, confined, dirty, flooded space and decide we wouldn't leave? It was in the 16th century, in the middle of the 16th century, in 1555, that the Pope herded the Jews into the ghetto under the impression that spreading Jews throughout Rome was a bad influence, and they should all be put in one place, and there they should live in wretched conditions, because that was part of the theology of the medieval church, that Jews should survive, but they should survive wretchedly, as evidence of what happens if you reject the truth. They were witnesses to error, and as witnesses to error, should be unhappy. And so, in that small space, by the banks of the Tiber River, the Jews lived. Now, if you go to Rome today, you will see that next to the Tiber River, there are large walls, walls comparable, actually, to the wall here, because the Tiber periodically floods. It cuts off the river from the city, that which was once an integral part of Roman life. When the Jews lived at the banks of the Tiber and they didn't have those walls, when the river flooded, the ghetto flooded. And when the ghetto flooded, the people who lived on the lower floors had to flee to the upper floors and wait there until the waters receded. So there was constant danger. Dank, sick-making conditions. And a sense always that there was a way out. Because there was a way out. One of the remarkable features of the ghetto is that, except for the one boundary that has the Tiber River, all around the ghetto are churches. The moment you step out of the ghetto, you step to the foot of the church. It not only increased the psychological pressure, as if to say, you are literally and spiritually surrounded. But it also presented, day after day after day, the way out. Step into this building, make a declaration, and you don't have to step back into that ghetto. And you have to ask yourself, why didn't they do it? Now, were there Jews who converted? Absolutely. But how did that small, beleaguered community survive? And I want to offer one reason today that I actually had not really thought about until the day that I walked around the ghetto and communed in as much as one can with those parents and grandparents and great-grandparents who were showing me their home. But in order to explain it, I have to say a few words about a concept in Judaism that takes a central place in our tradition. It's the concept of rachamim, of mercy. It comes from the word rechem, which means womb, a woman's womb, which gives birth to the idea of mercy, of being taken care of kindness. The Talmud says that the Jews are rachamim b'nei rachamim, that we are merciful people and the children of merciful people, and anyone who doesn't demonstrate mercy does not deserve to be called an Israelite. This was a concept that was taken seriously already in ancient Roman times when the temple was destroyed and Titus brought thousands of Jews back from Israel to Rome as slaves. The Jewish community of Rome in its entirety raised enough money to ransom every single one of them and set them free. It was a mandate of rachamim, of mercy, to make sure that captives would be free. That's our conviction about God. In the Bible, God's self-description before Moshe in the book of Exodus is Adonai, Adonai El Rachum, a God of mercy. The first word that God uses in self-description is merciful. Rachamav al kol ma'asav. God's mercies, the Torah teaches, are over all of God's works. We talked earlier this morning about the concept of forgiveness. You are not allowed to be cruel, says Maimonides in his code of law. You have to forgive. It is a mandate of rachamim, of being merciful. Which is not to say that you never get angry and you're never cruel and you never hate. But even there, the rabbis are very careful. There's a discussion in the Talmud of the mitzvah of ti'ina u'pricha, which is when someone else is bearing a terrible burden, there is a mandate, a mitzvah, to help them relieve the burden. And the Talmud goes on to say that if there are two people both bearing a burden, and one of them is hated and one of them is loved, your mandate is to help the hated person first. This, of course, is the beginning of a discussion. So then someone else comes along and says, well, maybe it's because the hate is illegitimate. And they say, no, the hate, we're talking real hate here. Deserved hate. We're talking about a Russia, a wicked person. By the way, there is a whole separate discussion about whether there is such a thing as a Russia, a person who is fundamentally wicked, which is a subject of disagreement among the rabbis. But for now, let's stipulate a bad guy. And then, the Tosafot, some of the most prominent commentators on the Talmud say, so if this person is really bad, why would you help him? If everybody agrees that this is, in essence, a rasha, a wicked person, what's the purpose of helping? And their answer is, you help him to prevent sina gmura, total hatred. In other words, you help him because you don't want hatred to grow. Because it is part of your mandate to fight back hatred in this world, even when it means being kind, and you don't want to be kind. Rachamim is taken that seriously. It's that important. Even God practices rachamim at unusual times. Let me tell you a beautiful story from the Midrash that illustrates this very well and brings us in some ways to the idea that I want to talk about this morning. Abba Tachna, the pious, once finds himself walking home, and it's almost Shabbat, it's the evening of Shabbat, and he sees someone lying at the gates of the city who is ill and can't make it home. And the guy looks up at Abba Tachna, who's carrying the packages of the food for Shabbat for his hungry family, and says, carry me home. And Abba Tachna says, if I carry you home, then it's going to be too late. It's already going to be the Sabbath. I won't be able to bring the bundles of food home, and my family will go hungry. And the guy says, I can't make it. Carry me home. So Abba Tachna, no doubt rolling his eyes at the heavens, puts down his bundles and picks up the man and carries it home. And as quickly as he can, runs back to the gates of the city to pick up his bundles, and he sees that the sun is about to set and he won't make it home, at which point God intervenes and stops the sun and gives Abba Tachna time to take his bundles home and then lets the sun set for Shabbat. Why? Because even God respects an act of rachamim. In the Talmud, the rabbis ask, does God pray? And they answer, yes, God prays too. And of course, then they say, well, what's God's prayer? What could God possibly pray? And their answer is, God prays, may my rachamim, my mercy, overcome my inclination to do justice. In other words, may I not punish, may I be merciful. So, I walked around the ghetto, and I thought to myself, Here was a people that was schooled in mercy and in kindness. And they were being invited to join this great and pious civilization, but the face that it showed them was one of cruelty. For anybody living in that confined space, the people around them must have appeared immeasurably cruel. And I think that above everything else, the Jewish community stayed together because it had a conviction that it could not be part of any community that would practice such unkindness. In the center of the ghetto, the very center, was a fountain and a gallows, as if to say, life or death. When you go to the Roman ghetto now, the gallows is gone. But it was there. And I am convinced that mothers told their children, when you grow up, don't be cruel as others are cruel to us. Be kind. And be part of a people that believes in kindness. And shows it to your people. I say this in part because one of the remarkable things that happened, as a coincidence, I suppose, was that in the process of visiting the ghetto, as I was there, people were talking about that day, the Pope's visit to Auschwitz. And I thought, first of all, what a remarkable symbolic statement it is, first of all, for a German Pope to visit Auschwitz, and second, to stand in the ghetto and contemplate that visit. He said some poignant and beautiful things. I wished, especially as I stood there, that he had pointed the finger not only out but in, that he had talked about how centuries of what the historian Jules Isaac called the teaching of contempt was not completely guiltless in what happened in Western Europe. And that lack of kindness was contagious, and the virus never went away. But with all that, we have reason to be grateful that the world is not what it was, and believe it or not, the ghetto is now some of the most expensive and desired property in Rome. The Roman ghetto is a good real estate investment. It is a remarkable thing and says volumes about the way in which civilizations have grown and the world, in some ways, has changed. What it reminded me more than anything else, though, was the message that a little less than a month ago Elie Wiesel reiterated in this sanctuary so eloquently and so beautifully, which is that it is the obligation of the Jewish people to protest and oppose cruelty anywhere in the world, because it was that hatred of cruelty that preserved us as a people. It was that conviction of the centrality of kindness that kept us close to the Torah and to one another. It is our task to respond to the hatred of the world, because we know what it is to be hated, and because we know what it is to be loved. I walked out of the ghetto, past the church, with mixed emotions. I thought how sad it was that for generations, Jews couldn't do what I was doing. how sad it was that in that place, the yellow star was first introduced that became such a badge of shame to the Western world. And yet, I could walk out. And I realized that the message was that although they were stuck there for generations, they still, spiritually, could reach beyond the walls of the ghetto to hand us their inheritance, to pass on our Torah. It is ours, of course, now that we live, thank God, in a land of kindness, to remember their plight and to preserve their message, and to ensure that what parents taught children in the ghetto is what we teach our children, that we are rachamim b'nei rachamim, that we are merciful people and the children of merciful people, that we are not shy to fight hatred and fight cruelty, but we are always quick to shine the sun of goodness, of kindness, and of God's love on an often dark and needy world. Shabbat Shalom.